What's the state of the art and the future of virtual reality technology? That's the topic today on Mind Matters News.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
We've been talking with Dr. Tom Furness at the University of Washington. He is a pioneer in virtual reality, has been called the grandfather of virtual reality because of his pioneering work in the field for the Air Force. He is a professor in the Department of Industrial and Systems Engineering in Seattle at the University of Washington and continues to do some fascinating cutting-edge work, and we're going to continue to talk with him today. Tom, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm having fun.
I am too. I'm having a blast, and I'm learning a lot. Tell us something about some of your other current projects. Maybe one of them is the Rat Lab, and we were talking offline, and it kind of reminds me of the Skunk Works, and I don't know why engineers use deplorable animals to describe what they're doing. But the Rat Lab stands for Rockin' and Thinkin', is that right?
That's correct.
And it's an incubator. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, you know, I was enjoying my activity at the university. Certainly a wonderful place to do research. But it is a bureaucracy. And I found that sometimes, having worked for the Air Force in the Department of Defense for 23 years, you know, I got used to the bureaucracy, but it sure does slow you down and reduce your flexibility.
Yes.
Especially if you want to try out things. And so I decided that what I needed was an outlet to do some pretty far out things that I wouldn't be able to do at the university because I would be labeled as a flake. Well, I am a flake, but I didn't want to be labeled as a flake, you know, and so in 2005, I was thinking about how can I hire some high school dropouts because these kids are brilliant, but the university would never hire them. And I had some projects I wanted to do that I wasn't particularly interested in giving away to the university because those were my own ideas, and they were orthogonal to things I was doing at the university. So I was driving home one day, and I just happened to glance over the side of the road. There was a house for sale not too far where my home is. And I started thinking about that. What if I could build a residential business, sort of a lab that would be like a garage shop operation where I was able to play with technology with a bunch of kids, adults, PhDs, kindergarten, whatever. And I could hire who I wanted to hire. I could knock holes in the wall if I wanted to. I could pay them what I wanted to pay them and not have to go through the bureaucracy that would prevent that from happening. Generate IP if necessary. Spin off companies. So I talked to my wife about this, and she thought I was crazy. But I convinced her that we needed to buy this house.
Okay.
So we bought this house and turned it into a lab. And I was kicking that around with my wife, and she's the one that actually came up with the name. She said, well, you know, experiments, you know, rats and things like that. And I said,
oh,
yeah.
Okay. And I get the connection now for rats. Okay.
Yeah. And so, the rats of NIMH, you know, there's a movie about that. And rats are pretty smart and really industrious. And so we decided the Rat Lab would be a good name, but rat doesn't mean what people think it is. It means, you know, we're going to be a rocking group of people.
Yes.
And thinking people. And I was thinking of sitting in a rocking chair, just sitting there and thinking. But there's a different connotation to rocking as well. So I started the Rat Lab as a Washington company, an LLC, that would be working on just investigating advanced technology. And I started working with some clients who said, could you help me with this problem? And I said, oh, okay. So I started looking at what they were trying to do. In this case, they were trying to use light to characterize matter. And I'm sort of a photonics guy. So I said, well, yeah, we could probably look at that. And so I gathered together some of my rats. And we started looking this, and we said, we wouldn't do it the way you're thinking about doing it. We do it
now,
entirely.
Now, by rats, you don't mean literal rats. You mean employees in your lab.
That's right. The kids and the employees that work at the rat lab are called rats, including me. I'm the king rat. And so we started looking at this, and lo and behold, we came up with two or three patents. And the company said, well, that's great. And could you develop us some prototypes? And we said, well, sure. And what I did was I chalked this house full of all kinds of technology. And we have, you know, we make our own electronic fabrication, printers and machine milling machines and things like that. And so we started making stuff. And they said, wow, this is pretty good. How would you like to take over all of our R&D? And I said, really? I mean, I want to play with stuff. And they said, well, you can do that too. And I said, well, it's really going to cost you. And they said, well, how much? And I said, $1 million. I didn't know. I just threw out that. And they said, okay.
Really? You know, of course, you didn't ask for enough.
Right? No, at that time, I said, good grief, I should have asked for two or three, you know?
Axel, absolutely. Yeah.
So anyhow, we got some money and we started playing around with technology, and we ended up with 20, I think it's 20 patents or something like that in this particular area. And then we got approached by a few other companies, one who wanted to work on what was called heart rate games. How do you use games as a means of helping people get healthy and with exercise machines? So what we did was figure out a way to take a bicycle, just your regular bicycle, plunk it into this machine, and you'd be pedaling away on this bicycle, and you put on a headset, virtual reality headset, and you become a dragon, and you breathe fire, and you start, and you're flying around in three-dimensional space while you're pedaling, and your paddling charges up your flamethrower, and you have to keep an energy level up on that flamethrower, and then you're flying around, and you have these dragons that are trying to attack you, and you're zapping them with your flamethrower and things like that. It's back to the pain thing we talked about before. You get completely distracted that you're exercising. And by the time 30 minutes is up, the game's over. And they say, really? We have to quit now? When in fact, you look at the profile of what you've done. We came up a way with doing adaptively. So we wanted to keep you in the zone of where you were sufficiently challenged, but it wasn't too much. You know, so that you would stay on this curve of exercising, and eventually over a period of time, you get to the point where you didn't have to have the game anymore. You felt really good exercising. And then it became a social thing. You wanted to compete with other people. And getting people over that hump of where exercising is unpleasant to where it is pleasant because you're fit, you're more fit. That was our objective, and we worked on that for a while with a company called Heart Rate Games. And then we spun off a few companies along the way. One of the projects I started working on was with the XPRIZE. I don't know if you've heard of the XPRIZE Foundation.
No, let me back up. Heart Rate Games, if I wanted to buy one of these, is it commercially available now?
Nope, it's not. As it turns out, Heart Rate Games went under.
Oh, no. This is such a great idea, Tom, and I need exercise.
Yeah. Well, you know, it would work, and we knew it worked. But the problem is the industry is dominated by a few manufacturers. And we started talking to those manufacturers, and they just were not interested. They thought, it's going to be too big a deal, too expensive. And, you know, we have a direct line to all of these fitness centers. And we were trying to convince them that this is the way to go. And so, as it turns out, we couldn't get through that particular roadblock.
I would think the home market would be really good.
Well, yeah. I mean, and it could transform this whole situation where it makes people uncomfortable to exercise. But if you no pain, no gain kind of thing, but we can make the pain go away and make it fun, make exercising fun. So you get to a point where you're fairly fit.
Well, keep me up on that because I want one.
You want one, okay.
Yeah, I want one, okay. So
that was one of the projects we worked on. And then another project, I started working with the X Prize Foundation. And X Prize, I don't know if you know about the X Prize Foundation, but they award these big prizes for accomplishing something, pressing the technology limit. And, you know, SpaceX won the X Prize for one stage to orbit. And there's an X Prize for mining on the moon and for acid in the oceans and things like that. And anyhow, this X Prize was a tricorder X Prize, the medical tricorder, like in Star Trek, where the doctor scans a patient non-invasively and tells what's wrong with them. So I was asked by the medical director of the X Prize, tricorder X Prize, if I would like to be a judge of this. Now, it turns out this guy used to work for me at the HIT lab. He's a physician, neurologist. He was actually on the staff of my lab at the University of Washington. And he went on and is a professor at UCSD, but he became the medical director of this project. He said, I'd like for you to be a judge. And I said, the heck with that. I want to be a contestant. And I want to build one of these tricorder deals. And as it turns out, I got involved. We signed up to be a contestant and started down that road. And then we found out that really this isn't going to take us anything advanced. We're just going to be integrating what's already out there. Because of the sponsor of the X Prize was, that's what they insisted. And I said, well, we're not going to do any blue sky work. And that I said, I think I'll just do my own X Prize. And so I got together with the rats and said, okay, we're going to do this. So I said, let's go to work and find out what's really killing people. And as we did the research, we found out pretty much it's heart disease. That is a silent killer.
Yes.
And people have heart disease and don't know it. And the way Western medicine works, they only intervene when you have an event, and that may be too late. You have a heart attack, and then you die, or you're injured for the rest of your life. And so there's not a whole lot that goes on in preventative heart disease. If you do have a good physician who does an EKG every year, you may be able to pick up on some of this, but EKG isn't too good, actually. Mm-hmm. So we started digging down and said, how can we come up with a warning system for cardiovascular disease? And we stumbled upon traditional Chinese medicine.
Okay.
Because these have been practicing this for 2,000 years, of where a traditional Chinese medicine physician will feel the pulse, the pattern of the pulse. They take the pulse with three fingers on the radial artery on your left arm and on your right arm too, but mainly the left arm. And they can tell pretty much what's going on in the body by sounding the body. The pulse actually is like sonar. It tells you what's going on throughout the body. And
they must have pretty sensitive touch.
Oh yeah. And I mean, it's a human pattern recognition thing. And they can tell by the timing and the shape of the pulse and things like that what's going on. Well, I didn't believe this. I didn't believe that that was really happening until we said, okay, where can we find one of these guys, these traditional Chinese medicine guys? And as it turns out, the largest traditional Chinese medicine clinic in the U.S. is over in Poulsbo, Washington.
Okay.
On the peninsula.
Yes.
And so we went over and talked to this guy. He actually came to us. And we said, we want to talk to him about this. And then what he did, the first thing he did is he went around the room. There were, I think, 8 or 10 of us rats, you know, around the room. And he went one at a time and felt our pulse and told us our whole history, medical history. I couldn't believe it. None of us could believe it. That he told us, and he didn't know us. This is the first time he'd met us. So this was beginning to make a believer out of me.
Well, you can't argue with success, can you?
That's right. And so we said, hey, how would you like to do a project with us? What we'd like to do is instrument you. What we'd like to do is digitize what you're feeling. Mm-hmm. And you tell us how you interpret what you're feeling. And what we'll do is build some machine learning algorithms. And then we'll take those patterns and build a library and be able to recognize, you know, what the diagnosis is based upon the pattern of the pulses. And so this would be sort of a holodoc kind of thing, you know. And so we started a project. We spun off a company from the rat lab called Pulse Tectonics. And Pulse Tectonics was working on a way to do this measurement. And we raised some money. And in the process, we found something else. We noticed that in some of the patients, some of us, we were you know, using our measurement system on ourselves, there was a strange bump that would occur sometimes and not other times in the pulse. We say, what is that? Sometime it's there and sometime it's not there. And we finally figured out by doing a, you know, some monitoring over a period of time that this had to do with we're hungry. When we're hungry, that bump appears. And when we're not hungry, it's not there. And we found, we said, well, what this is all about is we're actually measuring the shunting of blood to the stomach, to the digestive system that is being basically shut off. And when you're hungry, but the demand is there. And then when you eat, you're basically releasing that into the stomach. And we found that, you know, that was a correlation. And then we said, well, we wonder if we can determine with the pulse what you've eaten.
This is fascinating. Okay. And what you've eaten. Okay.
Yeah. And so we started doing some experiments. And we said, okay, well, let's this is all on ourselves, you know. Let's do a diet of protein. Let's do carbs and whatever, you know, and see if what and fat, and let's see if there's any difference in the pulse. Sure enough, there's a difference in the pulse. We could tell by looking at the pulse what you'd eaten. And basically what it was telling us is how the body reacts to what you've eaten in terms of, you know, the way it allocates blood supply. So, the more we looked into this, we said, good grief, this is a bigger market than cardiovascular disease, you know, the diet, the nutrition and diet market. So anyhow, we continued down this line. We had some patents, and we're ready to raise our next round of money. We had it identified, and then the Chinese market shut down. Basically, the investment resources of China to the USA started drying up.
I see.
This is even before the current administration.
I see.
And so all of our money was going to come, this next tranche of funding was going to come from China, because mm-hmm. they were the market. They were going to be where we introduced it, because we thought, well, why would China want this? Because they have the traditional Chinese medicine practitioners.
And it would be more open to Chinese sort of culture.
Yes. Yeah. Not only that, the traditional Chinese medicine practitioners, of which there are about 100,000 of them, said, we want this. And the reason we want it is we have no way of documenting what we've done. You know, it's just one of those things. We go feel the patient and give them some herbal medicine to make them better. And this way we have a record of it. And not only that, we could give them this system to take home so that we see what happens during the day.
So you could make it that cheaply then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was going to be really the most important part of it was the database. I mean, that was the most valuable part of it. And so we would make these things for, you know, it'd be $15 kind of thing. And it would, you know, it would in quantity, and then it would communicate with the cloud and access this database and the machine algorithms and things like that. And it'd spit back to you what was going on and what you needed to take in terms of herbal medicine. Now, these are Chinese herbal medicine, which is different than what we get at the drugstore here in this country.
Yes.
Now, the other reason they wanted to do this is because they wanted to be legitimatized in Western medicine.
Of course.
Because they're looked upon as, you know, sort of, you know, spooky medicine. And that was another reason for this.
Well, I even know the chairman of our department has a son that's both a medical doctor and practices acupuncture.
Oh, yeah.
And I know acupuncture has had the same sort of pushback.
Yes. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so anyhow, this guy, by the way, also practices acupuncture. And we talked about that too, and how it's relevant in this situation. So anyhow, that started the Pulse Tectonics Company with all these different variations. It's sitting there ready to go once we can get the money. You know, we were trying to raise, you know, like $5 million to take it to the next step to where we can field a bunch of units and start billing our database with that. So that is another spinoff that came out of the Rat Lab. There is another one that is sort of interesting. A colleague of mine, again, the guy that was I worked with on this XPRIZE, who is a physician, MD, PhD, neurologist. We were really interested, again, about vision and what's happening with the retina. And here in the rat lab, we took one of the bedrooms and we converted it into a chamber, a light isolation chamber, to measure the light that comes out of the eyes.
Out of the eyes.
Yes. We know that photons go into the eyes. And of course, the quanta of energy is released in the retina and using the Dobson molecules that send electrical signals eventually to the visual cortex. But we looked at the structure of the optical pathways and we said, there's almost like a U-turn there. And we're wondering if there isn't a feed-forward loop. So we built this chamber. We put in some detectors, photon detectors, cool detectors, and we started measuring photons that come out of the eyes.
Now, clearly, there's not enough photons coming out of the eyes where you can see somebody in the dark, is there?
No. No, this is what was called ultra-weak photon emission. And so it is, you have to use, photomultipliers in order to count these photons. But it's clear that there are photons that come out of the eyes, and these are in the visible spectrum. These are not, not a byproduct of normal metabolism, infrared or whatever.
Yes.
So that is another area that we're continuing to explore, because if there's something there, if this has something to do with what's going on in brain, with brain chemistry, then we have a portal, potentially a diagnostic portal into the brain. Especially with people that may have cognitive impairment, mild cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's, things like that. So again, this is one of those stumble upon kind of deals. And but I could do it in a rat lab, and I could do it cheaply and not have to worry about going through the whole university system. And so that was another reason for having it. I can tell you some more stories. For example, I was hired by a company to be named to actually build a virtual cockpit for them for a new search and rescue helicopter.
Oh.
And so one of the bedrooms we converted into a helicopter simulator. And this is a virtual cockpit for helicopters, because the real problem with search and rescue is these pilots are flying in these awful conditions, weather conditions, and they don't see. And we were going to provide a way for them to see and a way to hover, station keep, rescue people, things like that. So we started, we built a simulator to test some of our ideas, just like I did at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and had developed a whole new way of providing a cockpit for helicopters. So in the process of all of this, my rats were getting all kinds of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went on, the ones that went on from there. They loved it. And then they used that as a stepping stone to get to responsible jobs in industry.
Excellent, excellent.
And several of them I'd send to Australia and New Zealand to work on their graduate degrees, and based upon the experience they did here.
And so that's where you got the HIT labs at the University of Canterbury and the University of Tasmania, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things, there's a story about the HIT lab, in, especially in New Zealand. What happened, of course, when I was working in my office at the university, and I got the call from a dean's office saying, there's a delegation here from New Zealand who would like to come see your lab.
Uh-huh.
And I said, oh, okay. Apparently they had, they'd found something online and they thought it was interesting. And so they came, and I found out that they were members that Seattle and Christchurch, New Zealand, are sister cities.
Oh.
And they were up here as part of a sister cities delegation with the mayor and some university folks and the so-called Canterbury Development Corporation, which was basically their government incubator kind of thing to start companies in New Zealand. And so they show up in my lab. And I show them around, tell them what I'm doing, and we spin off all these companies, and we're doing this multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary activity that where we get generating all the patents, things like that. And they said, "Can we do that?" Now, at that point, I thought, if I play this right, I'm going to get a free trip to New Zealand.
New Zealand's beautiful, too.
Yeah, it is.
Yes.
And so, and I'd been there when I was in the Air Force. I actually had worked with the Royal New Zealand Air Force some. And as it turns out, one of my PhD students in electrical engineering, actually, Mark Billinghurst, was about to finish and graduate in EE. And I introduced them to him, and I was looking around for a job for this kid. So anyhow, they said, well, I told them maybe I should go to New Zealand and check it out. And they said, oh, would you come? I mean, we fly you down business class, bring your wife, you know, you can take some time off and get around and things like that. And I said, oh, maybe I'll do that.
Yes. You know, the beaches in New Zealand rival those in Oregon. They're just beautiful. Oh,
yeah. Well, as it turns out, when I got down there and they showed me around, and we had a blast just driving around the countryside, and they asked me, well, what do you think? I said, well, maybe I should come back. I have a sabbatical coming up, and I could spend, you know, 6 months here taking a look and see what we can develop. And they offered me an Erskine Fellowship to come back and spend 6 months. And then they introduced me to the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, all of the ministers, and the government said, we're going to do this. And we were going to form two entities, the HIT Lab, New Zealand Research Center, hosted by the University of Canterbury, and the HIT Lab New Zealand Limited, a company owned by the university and by the University of Washington, that would develop the technology once it happens in the research center.
And let's remind listeners that HIT Lab stands for Human Interface Technology.
Right. So what happened? We started the lab. And oh, by the way, one of the things that had to happen is I needed to be in New Zealand every year from January to the end of March during the winter quarter.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That's when it rains in Seattle, right?
Yeah, and other things.
Yeah, you know, our joke used to be it's like living in a car wash during that period.
Pretty much.
Yes.
And so the New Zealanders gave us a permanent residence visa. We bought a home, and we lived in New Zealand every year for 3 months during that period of time. And we started a lab. It's booming. My student became the director. He stayed for 13 years. Now we have a new director. They have gobs of money, gobs of students, generating the spinning off companies, and it's wonderful. Now, what happens is the Aussies see this. Oz, you know, looks over the pond and says, what are these Kiwis doing? And they came over and said, gosh, if the New Zealand people can do this, surely we can do it.
Of course.
So they wanted to start their own lab, HIT Lab, that would be a sister to the New Zealand lab and to the HIT Lab at University of Washington. And so they did. They started one in Tasmania. And it didn't grow as fast, but another one of my PhD students in electrical engineering became involved in that one.
And my goodness.
Yeah. So that's how it happened.
So you're all over the world right now. Tom, I'd like to continue for one additional podcast because we still haven't talked about AR Toolworks, your NSF grant, and I wanted your opinion on some of the futures of virtual reality. So could we do one more?
Sure, we'll do it.
Okay, we've been talking to Dr. Tom Furness at the University of Washington. He's the grandfather of virtual reality and started virtual reality when he was an officer in the Air Force. And as you heard in this podcast, continues to do exciting things today. So until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.